From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2014 when the National Center for Science Education set out to better understand how public school teachers were teaching climate change. And they discovered something interesting, maybe even a little horrifying. In the 2014-2015 school year nationwide, fewer than half of all science teachers were aware that more than 80% of climate scientists say that global warming is caused primarily by human activities. So what should we do about that? How can we teach the teachers? How should we be teaching students? Well, here's one idea. You can update standards wherever you are. That's happening in New York State. The New York State science learning standards go into effect in July. No discussion of climate change specifically until third grade, and not a lot of focus on climate change at least until middle school, but there will be new emphasis on climate itself, weather, and ecosystems. The idea is to set students up with the knowledge they'll need to understand what climate change is when they encounter it, and then start teaching the science in earnest around middle school and high school. Our panel this hour will talk about climate literacy, teaching climate change, the value of experiential learning, and the perils of raising a generation of kids that might not really understand it very well. Let me go ahead and welcome our guests for the hour. Lindsay Cray is here, executive director and co-founder of Earthworks Institute and a forest school instructor. Lindsay, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Evan. Thanks.
Also here is Tiara Washington. She's an earth science teacher at East High School and a mother of two. Tiara, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Also here is Cindy Culbert, who is a homeschool educator, mom of two, and is going to have a lot to say about experiential learning as well. Looking forward to the conversation. Thank you for being here, Cindy.
Thank you.
And Chris Lejeski is the director of the Montezuma Audubon Center, which we pass whenever we drive east, for the most part, right?
That's right, Evan. Good to be with you today.
Thank you for being here as well. Lindsay reached out, and right around, I would say, the perfect time, Lindsay, because producer Megan Mack and I have been talking about there's a lot of different events going on this month related to climate change, climate justice, marches, those kinds of things. But sort of top of mind for us is how we teach. And at the root of this conversation is a concern you have about what happens if we don't do it very well. What are your concerns about raising a generation of kids who might not understand climate and climate science and what it is very well?
I think to put it simply, we're not preparing them with the tools and the knowledge that they need to deal with what will be one of the most pressing issues that the human race has ever had to deal with. And we're setting them up for failure if we don't give them that opportunity to learn.
Remind our audience what you do with Earthworks.
Our organization is a nonprofit organization. It's based all in environmental education, whether that has to do with learning outdoors or in the classroom, although we do base most of our programming outdoors because that's where we feel like we can engage kids the most. We receive several grants from different organizations, both public and private, and all of that support is geared towards making sure mostly that urban youth and families, as well as suburban youth and families, get the opportunity to learn about the natural world and become engaged in that.
And so kids who come your way, I have this assumption that they're already more engaged, they're more interested, but maybe not. Do you find kids, generally speaking, pretty well educated on this stuff? Not very well educated? Tiara's already kind of shaking
about
her head.
About climate change? No. It's a very rare instance that I meet a kid who can understand and describe to me what the issue really is.
But let's say kids at what age, are you working with?
Oh, I work with kids from, kindergarten all the way through college.
And you still even pick a 10-year-old, 12-year-old, 14. We're not asking them to know the science in and out, and explain it on a really PhD level. But,
right.
But they're still struggling with the basic mechanics of what's going on?
I would say For those that I don't work with on a regular basis, we work with homeschool groups who I feel like because we've gone over this subject again and again, they could probably describe it in its most basic form. Mm-hmm. With public school students, I don't find that is often the case.
Wow. So how much are you following New York State standards and the debate about how to teach in classrooms and how those should be updated?
How do you mean, how well am I following?
How keen are you to the conversation about, how things should change and New York State's standards and and what that should be at what level?
When we design our programs for schools, mm-hmm. We base our the programmatic design off of the New York State standards, and depending on what grade level it is and what subject it is that we're teaching, we try to follow that to the T as much as we can while offering that experiential piece that they wouldn't normally get in the classroom. But it's a fine line for us to walk. I have worked in private schools where it's not so much a piece of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, and it would be different if you were in a different place. I mean, if you were in West Virginia, you'd be in a place where the state government is pushing back against standards changes because it's too much emphasis on climate change. And, you know, so at the very least, do you feel like you're in a place that is embracing climate science?
Very much. I don't think Earthworks would exist in West Virginia. More or less, we would not be on the radio talking about this issue. But here in Rochester, we feel people at the very least want to be informed, and that's a good place to start.
Okay. Let me turn to T.R. Worthington, who's an earth science teacher at East High School. T.R., I couldn't help but notice your reaction when I was asking Lindsay how well-versed kids generally are. You know, so when they get to you, they're in what grade?
Usually 10th, 11th grade.
Okay. And how would you say their level of understanding of climate change is?
I think they know the basic. Like, they've heard the term. They've heard climate change. They relate it to the ice caps melting. I think what the big issue is that they don't see how it's impacting them or them themselves having a role in it. Mm-hmm. So when you don't see the importance of you within a situation, you kind of don't have much buy-in. And, you know, so what we really need is to let them realize how important they are, like build that identity as like citizen scientists and see how it's impacting even Rochester, New York.
Okay. And do kids ever ask you, well, isn't there a debate about this? We heard that they don't know, or, you know, did that come up?
Yes, of course. And people say it's just cyclic or, what is the absolute proof? And that's when I love to say, you tell me. If you don't agree with what climate change is, if you don't think it's real, show me the evidence. And that's what I do in my classroom. I'm like, you know, please, if you disagree with something I'm saying, bring evidence to me. You know, you have every right to say, no, you're not right, but I want you to support what you're saying with clear evidence.
That's an interesting technique because you're showing them plenty of evidence that it is real,
yeah,
that it is caused by man,
yeah,
that there is all kinds of data. And what you're simply asking them is, you know, I'm not going to shut your voice out of the conversation.
Absolutely not.
But it has to be based on evidence.
Yeah.
And does that generally, do you ever get them saying, oh, okay, yeah.
Well, if it involves them doing more work, I'll just listen to what you're saying.
All right. So, and how do you feel about New York City? You agree with Lindsay that at least we are in a place that is embracing science, that wants to find the best way to teach this?
Yes. Yep. I know the schools are looking into the next generation science standards, and there's a lot of teachers meeting on how to incorporate them really well in the classroom. We, you know, as science teachers, I know we really want to have climate change be more of a focus.
Well, I mean, it was only 2 years ago that the National Center for Science Education wanted to do this survey to see how science teachers were teaching climate science. Does it surprise you, TR, that what they found in the 2014-2015 school year was that fewer than 50% of science teachers would agree and were aware that the vast majority of climate scientists say global warming is primarily caused by human activities? I mean, how do you feel hearing that? That less than half of science teachers in this country, as of 2 years ago, understood that, yes, there's no real debate that man is causing climate change. You know, that more than half would say, I don't know if we know if it's caused by man or if it's caused by solar flares or if it's caused by, you know, Twitter or whatever it is.
Right.
You know, that's a lot of science teachers. Does that trouble you?
It doesn't shock me. It does trouble me. It doesn't shock me because it kind of goes back to what you were saying with Lindsay that, you know, if she was in Virginia or
West Virginia,
mm-hmm, that she probably wouldn't have Earthworks there. You know, so I think it all depends on where you're at. If they just looked at New York State, I feel like the numbers would be a little bit higher.
I think that, and again, I'm not trying to be a homer here, but I think there's probably some truth to that. Do those numbers, by the way, Lindsay, bother you that you've got that many science teachers saying, well, there's a controversy, or if I teach it, I have to teach the controversy? There's a phrase you hear a lot.
Yeah, I don't mind the idea of teaching the controversy because as a trained scientist, your job is to look at both ends of the story, you know. So I would agree with Tiara that we ask students to show us the evidence because that's what real science is. But yeah, it does kind of keep me awake some nights, thinking that we're not all on the same page about how we should be teaching this and what kind of knowledge we should be disseminating to our kids.
Sure, and yeah. I think what we're going to be talking more about this hour is how education has a number of components, but if you want to really just kind of bifurcate it, there's the question of what should the standards be, what should teachers be teaching in a classroom, and experiential learning, trying to get outside the classroom, trying to see more of the world, trying to experience it more, not just sitting at a desk. And Chris Lajewski is the director of the Montezuma Audubon Center, which is, it's become kind of a conservation hub for environmental education. What kind of educational programs do you do out there?
So as one of 41 nature centers affiliated with the National Audubon Society, we are connecting with thousands of school children, homeschoolers, and families in active hands-on habitat restoration and environmental education learning. So we've opened our doors now. We've been open for 10 years. And because there is 50,000 acres of forests, wetlands, and grassland habitats at Montezuma, which is twice the size of the city of Rochester, just for comparison, we have a plethora of acreage to engage all these people in these programs. And so because climate change and the lack of knowledge of climate change is at the forefront for the National Audubon Society, we think it's very important that we offer these educational programs, connect school kids from kindergartners all the way up through high schoolers to these programs through the Montezuma Audubon Center.
I remember the first time I went out there and had a chance to really kind of be in the property, not just driving past it. Mm-hmm. I was blown away. And now my son knows that's where you might be able to see a bald eagle once in a while. If you're driving by, you see a lot of cool birds of prey. But it's more than that. And I wonder now, it's one thing to talk about the cool wildlife you're going to see there and different processes. It's another to say, is climate change impacting what's happening there? Can you see it? Are you noticing changes in different ways there?
Sure. Just for example, this year, just had an amazing phenomenon. It occurs every spring, the snow goose migration. These are geese that are white. They're about the size of a Canada goose, and they typically migrate through the Montezuma Wetlands Complex in March. This year, they came through the third week of February, and we have never, ever seen that before. We had about 500,000 of these birds that were overwintering down in the Chesapeake Bay and Delaware Bay. They fly pretty much nonstop to Montezuma to rest, to utilize the wetlands and the lake habitats that we have, and then head on up to the breeding grounds in the tundra of Canada. So now, is that a direct reflection of climate change? This February being one of the warmest that we have ever experienced, yeah. I got to say, yes, indeed, we are seeing the effects at Montezuma.
Okay. And I suspect as we see more of those, people may ask you, okay, but does it matter? Okay, the birds, you see them earlier. Does mm-hmm. that matter? Should mm-hmm. that matter to us?
Right. Well, it does because when as the climate is warming, the available food sources may not be readily available mm-hmm. for the birds as they are migrating through. So this occurs for waterfowl like snow goose. It could also take place with hummingbirds. You know, if the pollinator species, the wildflowers, are blooming earlier than the hummingbirds are coming through and migrating through on their way northward, they may not survive that impressive journey to breeding grounds, and they may not survive.
Talking about climate change and teaching climate change, the different ways we teach it, how standards have been evolving, and we'd love to hear from you if you have thoughts on this, particularly if you think about the education you got growing up, or if you want to talk about the way your kids are being taught. If you have any thoughts about how we should work with teachers who still want to, quote, teach the controversy, which is, according to the National Center for Science Education, a problem, but it happens in a lot of places. fortunately not too often around here. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Cindy Colbert is a mother of two and chooses to homeschool. And you get a lot of flexibility, a lot of experiential learning. But why don't you start by telling us why you made that decision to homeschool?
Well, I made it pretty much right from the beginning. I met a homeschool family out in New Mexico, and seeing how they work together and learn together and live together all the time was really inspiring to me. And I decided that I wanted that for my family, and to be outside more, to be able to travel at our leisure, to just have more freedom in our life and be together more. So that's a choice we've made, and we pretty much experiential learning is our life. We travel a lot. My children have taken, actually, I think I asked Lindsay the first time we ever took one of her classes through the Brainery, do you have a class for homeschoolers? So we pretty much started the class for homeschoolers together. So my kids have been in it since that time. We were just at Montezuma Wildlife Refuge a few days ago looking at all the migrating ducks. And we've been across the country three or four times now, visiting national parks, seeing all of the beautiful places that hopefully will be preserved for their grandchildren in the future. So that's pretty much what we do.
Okay, and your kids are how old?
11 and 13.
11 and 13. Were you thinking about the value of teaching climate change to them from an early age, or has that really picked up in the last few years?
It's always been a concern to mm-hmm. me. We do a lot of things just in our daily life to reduce our impact. You know, we have one car. It's a Prius. We walk or bike where we can. We, you know, buy secondhand clothes so that to reduce the impact of, you know, waste and also chemicals and stuff in our own life. So it's always been a consideration, and it's, you know, going through the national parks, there's lots of ranger-led talks that we go to, and that climate change is... it's interesting. It's always discussed, but it's not always those terms aren't always used.
That's interesting. What do you mean, intentionally or unintentionally?
I think intentionally. Oh, we noticed at Acadia in Maine this year, the ranger was talking about pretty much what you were talking about. I forget your name.
Chris
was talking about just now about the when the plants would start to bloom, and if the animals that pollinated them came before or after because of climate change and the temperature and the light, they, you know, what they base their migrations on and what the plants base their blooming on, if those cycles aren't in unison, then plants either aren't going to get pollinated or animals aren't going to be fed. But he never said this was because of climate change. And I thought that was very interesting almost immediately. And I was wondering if it was to not offend, you know, visitors that they have from all over the country and the world, so that they can present the ideas but not call it climate change, which some people might obviously don't believe in. So,
well, and Chris, I mean, obviously that's not a term that you shy away from, but how much in the industry-wide do you hear that kind of thing?
Well, climate change is at the forefront, and it's one of the most pressing concerns for the National Audubon Society in terms of birds and their habitats. The National Audubon Society is proud to partner with a number of organizations, and we're all focused on preserving habitats, conserving these wonderful resources that we all depend on. It's not just for birds, because when we preserve habitats, wetlands, and forests, we're also preserving the quality of our air and our water that we also need to survive. So we simplify it, to Tiara's point, to make it more readily accessible and comprehensible to our guests. We simplify it, and we make the direct links between climate change and the value of conservation to our visitors. And when they understand that by planting trees and removing invasive plants and preserving water quality is good for birds and for people, then they're on board. and we can all make a difference.
And it sounds to me like you're just not at all interested in politics. Who cares about the politics? It's just science. So if climate change is real, if the climate science is worth teaching, you teach it. You don't ask what your political affiliation
is. The National Audubon Society is a conservation and education advocacy organization, and we base our work on sound science. And when you have 97% of scientists say that climate change is real and humans are the cause, that's it. I mean, there is no debate. The debate is how are we going to react and mitigate these challenges, not only for birds, but for people as well.
All right. So as we go throughout the hour, we're going to talk to you more about opportunities you have if you want to, for example, check out the Homeschool Nature series out there.
That's
we'll
right.
talk about that. You want to learn more about Earthworks and what Lindsay and the organization does there. But I want to get some phone calls because our phones have lit up. So let me just grab a few calls first. And I'm going to start with Fred in Penfield. Go ahead, Fred.
Yes, I just wanted to add something to the discussion. I work with older people in discussion groups every week and have for the last several years. Usually we just do a lot of discussing around global warming because it's beginning to warm up as a topic. If science is not credible, and I have to underline that, if science is not credible to society today, we need to take it, each one of us, to our friends and our neighbors and our companions at work. But not science. You pick up the paper, increasingly, you can't find any scientists who argue against it. They keep their mouths shut. But what you can't find is media announcing it broadly. You can't find media talking about Greenland or talking about New Jersey or talking about Miami or talking about the animals in the South Sea. And in the Atlantic, or the way somebody says that the weather is changing for the swallows coming south. The point is, there are articles in the paper and our journals, and even on your nice show, every day that repeat the facts, and the facts are terribly interesting if people repeat them to other people, but they have to be ready and educated themselves, because the only way we can do this is teach, like somebody was saying, teach it to the point where we've got 10-year-olds saying how can they contribute to the war on global warming, like World War II. All right, that's cool.
Thank you, Fred. It's a lot of thoughts on what we can do to make sure people understand. It sounds to me, Lindsay, like Fred is connecting events, mm-hmm. whether it's some of the things Chris was talking about, seeing birds migrate in different times, or we talked about the wine industry last week and the way grape growers are impacted. Mm-hmm. He's connecting individual events in a way that keeps climate change at top of mind. What
right.
do you think?
And I think that comment couldn't have come up in a better conversation, because what I'll say, and I'll piggyback off of what Chris said, and Tierra as well, I think we're all on the same page here, is that as educators and as scientists, it has now become our responsibility to both not only present the facts, but also to walk this fine line of being the diplomat for the rest of the general public, so that we are presenting the issue in a way that does not alienate people, but brings people into the conversation, that brings all of these different issues like the grapes, like the migration, like pollination, water flow, all of these different issues that impact our climate and how our climate impacts those things, mm-hmm. And help people to understand how the whole ecosystem, the global ecosystem, is connected. And I think in that, there really is no argument. And if we can keep the conversation there, then we begin to grasp more of those people who don't know so much, but who might be curious to learn more, because it's harder and harder to ignore what's happening, because the evidence is presented to us no matter where you look. You know, the crazy windstorms we're having in the winter with barely any snow, and the temperatures that are just way out of normal. for what goes on here seasonally in Rochester. We're all seeing it. So having somebody that can present those facts to you in a way that engages you, that's where we need to be at.
Tara?
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. What I see is, you know, with my global environment class, and we start laying all this information out to the students, and they're like, oh, this makes lots of sense. I see how it's impacted me. I see it in Rochester. Their next question is, well, why doesn't everybody else see it?
Always.
And that is when you show them the debate. That is when you show them, why do people maybe say, no, this isn't real? What I've done was I've showed them areas that's kind of like a poor area that makes lots and lots of money out of fracking, that makes lots and lots of money out of using fossil fuels. And those are those delicate situations that you have to be understanding of to understand why people would want to say, well, climate change is probably just something that's, you know, cyclic or not real, you know, because it's really impacting their lives. So to see the pros and cons and have an understanding, so then we can go forth and think of ways to alleviate certain situations or help out those people who rely on fossil fuels as a way to feed their family.
Right, talking about job alternatives, for example. You don't have to just rely on that. You can do this as an example. And talking about climate change is another medium to talk about job creation and STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. You know, one of the ways to combat climate change issues is to train our students in science, technology, engineering, and math, and let them be the ones that come up with the great ideas to mitigate the issue.
All right, before I get back to your phone calls, I want to get an email question for Lindsay and Tiara, the educators in the room. Nicole wants to know, how do the educators on the panel deal with parent deniers? Do you encounter that much, Lindsay?
I don't encounter it in this position. I have encountered it before. I worked for an organization out in California, and if you know anything about Central California, it is all ag, all big industrial ag, and that's what their economy runs on. And I was an environmental educator out there, and there were some buzzwords that we were not allowed to use. And sometimes you would come across a buzzword that you didn't know was a buzzword until you said it, and parents would put their hands up and starkly disagree with you. And the way I handle that is just explaining fact. Like, this is science, here's the data, this is where we pull the data
from. Can I ask you a question? I mean, is this like, for example, in some parts of California, they don't want to talk about the fact that almonds need a lot of water.
Right.
Those kinds of things. So in the ag industry, we don't want to talk about certain things needing certain, is that kind of what you
pretty
mean?
Much. So we okay. would, the organization I worked for was a land trust, and so we really focused on conservation of land, much in the same way the Audubon Society does. But our main hotspot to kind of navigate between this whole idea of diplomacy was what the negative environmental effects were of industrial agriculture. So putting too much pesticide, too much fertilizer, things like eutrophication, soil degradation, using too much water, those were real hot spots to talk about in classes, especially where parents were involved. You know, if people want to butt heads with you, you know, obviously diplomacy is the first thing, but the second thing is just to say, you know, this is the organization I work for. This is where we get our facts. These are the organizations that we partner with. And we have the information, we have the data. So there's really nothing more that we can say to change the way this conversation is going.
And that's what you do now? If you encountered a parent denier?
If I did, yeah. I'm happy to say that I don't have that issue in Rochester.
Okay.
You know, it's not to say that I wouldn't, and I'm sure that there are people that would disagree with me, but nobody has yet brought it to the forefront, but I'm always happy to have that conversation.
Well, you just wait the phone. There's three phone lines open. We'll see. Tiara, go ahead.
To be honest, I've never encountered that. The only way I'd say I might encounter that is if their children are saying, I don't believe you. And I never tell a student that they're absolutely wrong. They're completely entitled to their ideas. Again, it's just, I'm going to present you with evidence and facts, and I want you to do the same if you
right.
want to have this argument with me.
Okay. I'm late for our only break. We're going to come back to your phone calls, and then in our second half hour, we're going to talk more about experiential learning and the value and the opportunities we have in the Rochester area to do more of that. So let's continue the conversation when we come back with, you just heard Tiara Worthington, who's an earth science teacher at East High. You heard Lindsay Cray, executive director and co-founder of the Earthworks Institute, Chris Lejeski, director of the Montezuma Audubon Center, and Cindy Culbert, who's a mom, a homeschool educator, and we'll continue with your phone calls next. And let me tell you what's coming up tomorrow. You've probably heard of the Abundance Food Co-op. We've talked about it a number of times. They've got a new store that they're opening, and they have a lot going on as they get ready to have an Earth Day March coming up. They've got a chance to really expand their mission. And so it's sort of a multifaceted conversation with the folks from Abundance Food Co-op in the South Wedge. You're going to enjoy that conversation tomorrow, among other things, on Connections. Anybody. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let me get back to your phone calls. Joel in Rochester has been waiting. Go ahead, Joel.
Really quickly, I wanted to mention that, I never took earth science in high school or in eighth grade either. So my comment is that, you know, this education and curriculum needs to be across the curriculum and across grades. That'd be my first comment. It can't just be a standalone class. It needs to be in every grade level that we're teaching this. David Orr, a rather well-known environmentalist and environmental educator, he said, however conceived, described, or analyzed, sustainability is the issue of our time, all others being subordinate to the global conversation now underway about whether, how, and under what terms the human experiment will continue. So you can't really have conversations about poverty, about food scarcity, about any number of issues without addressing, you know, the concerns about the environment, first and foremost. The second thing really quickly is that we need to be, I think, acknowledging the role of animal agriculture, which is another too taboo topic, not only in K-12 education, but also college education, especially in dairy country like we are here. And then lastly, I agree with Tiara's comment that this is not just science. You know, it's science tied to ethics, social justice, art, racism, equity, public policy, you name it, so that we can ultimately have students taking some kind of informed action at the end of the day.
Joel, thanks. I mean, that lines up with what we heard from Fred earlier, tying things together, not just having one standalone class. Tiara, he was addressing some of the comments you made. Do you agree with what you just heard from Joel?
I absolutely agree. And I think with the Next Generation Science Standards, that is what they're trying to do, is to just continue to build upon that understanding of the climate change.
All right. Let me ask the parent on our panel, Cindy, who's choosing to homeschool. You know, but Joel is painting a picture for what public schools can do better here. What do you think of what you just heard from Joel, but connecting all of those themes?
I think it's very spot on, and it does sort of tie into what we are able to do with our homeschooling, that we can, you know, look at all sides of different issues within any genre that we're looking at. You know, if you're, I don't know, I could probably come up with a million examples that would waste our time, but it's everything's not segmented, so we can see it from all different perspectives, and that's what we try to do when we, you know, with Lindsay, I'm sure that, you know, they learn all different kinds of things with her, and doing, you know, they're running and jumping and playing, but they're also, you know, exploring their whole world and learning about, I don't know. I'm going to stop now.
No. This is, in fact, before I get back to the phone, so if you're on the phone, hang there for a second. Lindsay, tell us a little bit more about what a forest school is, what your mission is. If you are successful with what you want to do, what you're building, what's it going to look like a year from now, 3 years, 5 years from now?
Specifically with forest school?
Yeah.
It's going to be every day of the week instead of just Mondays and Tuesdays.
And where are you doing it?
Our board member owns 6 acres of property, and that property is very close to Ellison Park there off of Browncroft Boulevard. And so we run forest school on that property.
And who comes to you?
We have people that come all the way over from the west side of the city, near like the St. Paul Seneca Park Zoo area. We have people that come in from Victor. We have people that were thinking about coming all the way from Batavia, but unfortunately for this session, we're full. So that's a good thing for us. But our mission and vision specifically with Forest School is to take education to an interconnected level, meaning that, yes, we are teaching about fire building, and we're teaching about the safe, ethical way to build fires with Leave No Trace being the core focus of that. But why do we teach about Leave No Trace? Well, because we are the stewards of the land. And why do we need to be the stewards? Because we're the you know, the primary users of the environment. And so not only do all other animals within, you know, the web of life depend on us to maintain that forest and to not be breaking down trees and, you know, tearing up land and creating a bunch of erosion and off-track impact, but also because it's our job to preserve the environment for the future. So we don't just build fires wherever, and we don't just drink whatever water is in front of us. And we also need to make sure that we're not dumping our trash into that water, because if we dump trash into that water, that could be possible drinking water for other animals or other species, then we're polluting the water for other animals and other species. But also at the same time, with water, how do we purify water so that we can drink it? So I could go on and on, but I think the ultimate goal is for kids to understand how to use the environment in a sustainable way, and why that role in the environment is so important for humans to manage.
Okay, and your possible clients are any school that wants to send them to you, is that right?
For homeschoolers, it's literally any homeschool family that, you know, has the time and availability to join our program. We also run summer camp programs, okay, so that you can do this kind of thing during the summer, whether you're homeschool or public school, and you can be there out with us for 6 weeks if you wanted to, but, you know, as short as a week program if you want to. And we have two different locations to make that happen, Webster and Brighton. And then for schools and organizations, all you have to do is contact us, and we can kind of create a program that fits to whatever it is you're teaching in class that you want to expand upon.
And do you think kids are leaving these kind of programs, even when not every lesson's about climate change per se, but with a better chance to, as Joel says, connect climate to a wide range of issues?
Oh my God, yes. I had a parent email me last week saying that her kids came home talking about what an amazing day they had, and her oldest said to her, "We're just out there just learning about these things, but now that I think about it, they never taught us specifically about this stuff. We're just kind of learning it. Wait a minute. How do we know that?" And the idea is that, like, we're not having a lecture. There's no PowerPoint presentation or homework handout. Like, we're allowing them to experience the world, and they're asking us questions, and we're responding to their questions with prompts that ask them to think critically about those answers and to help find their own answers. And I think it's just in the way that you teach it that you really plug into a kid's need to play and to experience and be tactically, physically engaged with the world, and they will learn it. You know, that's how we make it happen.
I've got more I want to get through, but I've got to get through more of your phone calls because a lot of folks have been waiting. Kathy in Fairport next. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was in college in the early 80s, and there was a class that was required for engineering students, and with an elective for others. It was presented by a combination of the School of Science and the School of Humanities. I think it was called something like Man in a Technological Society. At any rate, what they did was they showed math modeling of various threats to humanity that theoretically we engineers were going to solve someday, and extrapolated the currently known data into the future under a variety of different scenarios. A couple of the things that they modeled were global warming and the threat of terrorism, which was, you know, obviously 30-some years ago. And it boggles my mind that much information was known and being studied at that time by scientists and presented at the college level at a little mediocre university, and that it's still not finding its way into school curriculum at any level. So it just dismays me that much information was known and was being communicated in 1983, but we're still debating whether or not it's real and whether or not we should teach it. That's about all I have to say it's dismaying.
Kathy, thank you. I mean, certainly James Hansen spent much of the 80s trying to convince his colleagues. And by the time we hit the 90s, I think Kathy's point's a good one here, that it wasn't, it wasn't as mainstream as it is today, but she's wondering how in the world we can be decades later with this. And Tiara, are you optimistic that what she's describing, she's dismayed about it, but it's about to change, that it's getting more a regular part of curriculum and classroom at various levels?
I definitely see individuals, groups coming together and really fighting hard for that to be very common in the classroom. I always see it here, but again, it's Rochester, it's New York, and there are, you know, other areas that we have to be concerned about. And I kind of wanted to feed off of what Lindsay was saying too, is that the big thing is when we're thinking about this stuff is seeing your connection. Okay, so like where your clothes come from. You just put your clothes on daily. You drink water daily, but when you start thinking about it, where do you get that water? Where do you get those clothes? We have to take care of the environment first, because that's where we're taking all this stuff from. And that is the main connection I feel the students are making with those.
Let me get one more phone call. And I want to mention that we had a call from a woman who wanted to check in earlier. She's not on the line anymore, but her name is Anna. She's in Henrietta. She teaches at RIT. She's formerly from California. And as a scientist, she said she wanted to thank the panelists for teaching about climate change. She says scientists deal with facts and often don't really have the tools to engage in debates with people who don't listen to facts, that it can be a big challenge. And this all ties into a study, you know, not just, I would say not just a study, but a conversation in the national science community about what to do about this. So I opened the program by mentioning the National Center for Science Education conducted that survey 2 years ago, trying to figure out what do science teachers teach? What do they believe about climate change? And one of the recommendations from the National Center for Science Education is that teacher education programs should anticipate and equip future teachers to deal with the politicization of science in general, but climate change as well. That right now, it's part of the deal, that you will probably encounter some level of politics, some pushback, some denial of facts based on a political ideology, and that as a teacher, you got to be ready for that. You know, that may be part of it. And let me grab our next phone call. This is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, to talk to the educators and the homeschooler, you know, I look at it. I enjoy in back solar energy, wind turbine energy, et cetera, but I believe that most of the climate change is not made man-made. It's solar. It's caused by the sun. And I think it sounds to me like the kids are getting educated on one side of the story without enough evidence from the other side of the story. As an example, recently there were three climate researchers at MIT that drew a conclusion that CO2 was very beneficial to our environment and that it was overblown. So I'm just wondering if your panelists are being too one-sided.
Okay. Thank you, John. This is a perfect example. I'm going to start with Lindsay Cray. Lindsay, if John were a parent and, you know, his kids were coming to your programs and this was the message for him. John, by the way, I met John in person last week. He's a lovely guy. He would probably talk to you all day. He's a really sweet person, but he's got this viewpoint. And by the way, it's never changed an inch ever. But Lindsay, what would you say to John?
I would say hi, John, and thank you very much for calling in, because this is a perfect opportunity for us to be able to have a discussion. So you're welcome to call me anytime, and we can certainly talk more about it. But I would just begin by saying that as a scientist, the way that I kind of baseline explain the issue with CO2 is that it is very much like carbon dioxide acts like a goose down blanket. So imagine a goose down blanket in the atmosphere. Goose down has a lot of ability to hold in heat. So the thicker that goose down blanket is in our atmosphere, the more heat is held into the Earth's surface. And there is very little evidence that would dispute the fact that the human population on the geologic timeline has pumped in more carbon dioxide into our atmosphere than has ever been recorded on a geologic timeline. So just for the sake of not taking up too much time on the air, if you just kind of put both of those things together, it's it would be a little bit difficult for me as a scientist to believe that something like, and I think this is what you were referring to is a solar flare, would have the level of impact that we are currently experiencing, given what we know about how much carbon dioxide we are producing as a civilization.
Let me also just tell you, John, you're talking about Richard Lindzen, who is an MIT professor. He's retired, and he recently acknowledged accepting thousands of dollars from the fossil fuel industry. Now, he did send a letter to Donald Trump urging him to withdraw from the Paris 2015 agreement, which prompted many of his own colleagues who are scientists who are not retired, who are not taking money from the fossil fuel industry, to send a letter following up saying, please do not listen to Richard Lindzen. He's not credible on this. He, according to the Boston Globe, also has been railing about how he thinks CO2 is good for the environment. But again, this kind of goes back to the whole, well, Lindsay just, I think, covered it pretty well. It also goes back to the whole bell pepper analogy. Bell pepper is good for you. Do not eat 50 pounds of it today. You know, so Richard Lindzen is a real person. And I don't think he's viewed very credibly in the scientific realm. So hopefully, John, that's a little information that maybe you didn't have. And maybe this will change your mind. But I appreciate it, the phone call, John, as always, John. And I'll just say again, I mean, John's one of the regular callers, and it was nice to meet him in person last week, and it's always interesting to see what will move people one way or another. TR, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I would love to jump in. I would, if John was one of my students' parents, I would welcome him into my classroom because I would use it as a learning experience for them to see how two people with two different ideas could debate an idea. And so I would even allow him to present his ideas, why he thinks what he thinks. Of course, have him share his resources. I would do the same. And, so they can learn to think critically. They can get the information from both sides and make their own decisions on what they feel.
Sure. Richard Lindzen's predecessors were the people who were like, come on, a round planet. Hello. It's flat. I mean, you're hanging on here. And that's okay. It's just, John, I would say Richard Lindzen, if Richard Lindzen were a student in TR's class and used the evidence that the Boston Globe is saying he used in his letter to Donald Trump, he would probably fail. Evidence matters. But I appreciate the phone call. Let me also make sure we don't lose the hour here. And I want to ask one of our guests, Chris Lajeski from the Montezuma Audubon Center. We've been talking about what Earthworks does and the forest school and the opportunities parents have and schools have to do more, to get outside the classroom. I know you have a homeschool nature series.
That's
as well.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, we've been leading the Homeschool Nature Series out at the Montezuma Audubon Center for 10 years that the center has been open. And we have welcomed homeschool families from as far away as Rochester, city of Syracuse, and Ithaca. That's an hour plus drive to Savannah, New York, where the Audubon Center is located. And we engage the entire family in these Homeschool Nature Series. Just this past month, we invited some of our colleagues who are falconers to the Audubon Center, and they explained to 20 wonderful young people and their families about the history of falconry and how falcons are used in modern times. That's unbelievable experience for anyone. And I think that these homeschool families that come to us every month for some hands-on and minds-on activities are looking for some out-of-the-box activities, something that they can't do at home. So we're so fortunate out at Montezuma to have a dozen wildlife biologists working to conserve all that habitat. And one of the really interesting activities that we get the homeschoolers involved with is a duck banding project. Montezuma is a critically important bird area for hundreds of thousands of migratory waterfowl. And every early fall, the homeschoolers come out and work side by side with the wildlife biologists, putting little bands on these birds that are then going to migrate south to the wintering grounds. And that information that is on that band that is then collected at some point in the future by conservationists can tell us a lot about where the birds are migrating, how their range is expanding, how their migration timing is changing in a warming climate as well. So we offer a lot of great educational programs for homeschool families, pretty much targeting the 5-year-old to 12-year-old age range.
How do they get in touch with you?
We've got a website, ny.audubon.org/Montezuma, also very available on Facebook, very active on Facebook as well, and we have some great upcoming homeschool programs later on in the spring.
Forest School and Earthworks, they want to get involved with you. How do they find you, Lindsay Cray?
We are pretty much everywhere you could find us. We are in the newspapers. We are on the internet. We have Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You can go onto our webpage. It's very user-friendly. Everything you need to know is there.
All right, and there's an earth science teacher in the room, so I have to end this program with a bit of recent news, and I want to ask you how you would respond to this. You might have seen on PBS or NPR the story of the Heartland Institute, which is a sometimes libertarian, sometimes conservative-leaning think tank that rejects the scientific consensus on climate change. They are mailing a book called Why Scientists Disagree About Global Warming to science teachers across the country. They're also mailing a DVD rejecting the human role in climate change and arguing instead that rising temperatures have been caused primarily by natural phenomena, in spite of all the scientific evidence. That material will be sent to 25,000 teachers every 2 weeks until every public school science teacher has a copy, according to Heartland. And a cover letter with the package asks teachers to consider the possibility that the science is not settled, and if that's the case, students should know there's a debate. That's coming the way of science teachers across this country. Heartland said last week they're going ahead with that plan. So if and when you get that DVD and that message from Heartland, what do you do with it?
So I have heard about this. Actually, one of our teachers have received it. What I would do is I would read it, watch the DVD, so I'm prepared to have better information and a better argument for those who do want to argue this, you know, with me.
But it's probably not going to change your mind?
I don't know. Maybe. No.
Well, okay. But it sounds like it's coming your way, though.
Yes.
And Lindsay, do you have a problem with that, by the way?
No, I was just giggling.
No, I mean, like, do you have a problem with the fact that the Heartland Institute is sending this material to science teachers around the country?
On a personal note, yes, but on a non-personal note, it just gives science teachers that much more information to work with if they're going to have a conversation with people because they want to know where the other side is coming from. So why not have that available?
Well, very interesting. A lot going on in the news related to how we teach climate science. And I just want to thank our guest, Lindsay Cray from Earthworks. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Tiara Worthington. Tiara, good luck to you in the classroom, and thanks for taking the time to join us here.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see you out along the thruway. And hopefully we get off the thruway and come see you in person, Chris.
Please
thank
do,
you
Evan. Thank
here.
You.
And good luck to you and your family. Thanks for sharing your story
thanks
with us.
Thanks for having
today.
Me.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a beautiful afternoon, and we'll talk to you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.